Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
WordSpring is a creative writing conference put on by teachers and students at Butte College who are passionate about writing. The sixth annual WordSpring conference takes place tomorrow on the Butte College campus and will feature award-winning author Andrew Lamb, who is my guest today. Andrew Lamb was born in South Vietnam, where he led a privileged life as the son of a general in the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. Exactly 42 years ago today, an 11-year-old Andrew and his family left Vietnam inside a C-130 cargo plane full of panicked refugees. Today, Andrew Lamb is an award-winning syndicated writer, an editor and co-founder of New American Media, and the author of three books, Perfume Dreams, Reflections on the Vietnamese Diaspora, East Eats West, Writing in Two Hemispheres, and Birds of Paradise. His essays have appeared in the New York Times, the LA Times, San Francisco Chronicle, and Atlanta Journal, among other papers. He was a regular commentator on NPR's All Things Considered for 8 years. Andrew Lamb, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Now, people would probably wonder, well, if you were a commentator on NPR, what did you comment on?
Well, you know, a lot of commentaries on NPR tend to be personal, family kind of oriented narratives, cultural pieces. And that's what I usually did my commentaries on. You know, my memories of my grandmother or practicing vegetarian for a bit, or traveling to Vietnam and watch the changes in Vietnam taking place in the post-Cold War periods and stuff like that. I think for a long time, NPR really enjoyed that kind of cultural, personal narrative. And it's unfortunate that commentaries are on its way out from NPR, because a lot of people told me that's their favorite part of NPR.
Yeah, and I remember people like Eric Severide on CBS, and I missed that.
Yeah.
Well, you did mention commentary on going back, how your home country, where you were born, how that has changed. And then you were the subject of a PBS documentary in 2004 called My Journey Home. And to what extent were you involved in its production?
It's a difficult thing to do, documentary, because you don't just go in and film something. You kind of have a script, even though it's reality.
Mm-hmm.
So I was involved in designing who we were supposed to interview when we get back to Vietnam, you know, the relatives that I left behind, and submit all that to the communist government, because they're very, you know, controlling. It's a police state after all. And then suggested places where we would visit, and also the home that I grew up in this small town called Dalat, and all that had to be sort of written into the script before we actually filmed.
Well, you mentioned it's a police state, so maybe for people whose memory might be a little rusty, why don't you give us a little brief history of what happened after you left where you were born, South Vietnam?
Yeah, well, you know, as most Americans probably remember, there was a war, and it went on from the late 50s to 1975 when it ended. And it was a civil war that was supported by so many superpowers. North Vietnam was supported by the Soviet Union at that time, and China. And South Vietnam was supported by the U.S. and its allies. And so it was a small country in which Cold War took place and turned hot. And so there was a lot of devastation, and the war ended, in which the South was abandoned by the U.S. by 1973. And it fended for itself for two more years. And then the inevitable happened, where North Vietnam overtook the South. And so afterwards, it imposed a very draconian police state onto Vietnam in the aftermath of the war, sort of its own cultural revolution after China. And subsequently, there were a lot of Bo people who left because of the difficult conditions of Vietnam at that time. I was lucky because I left before it all ended. But as an American kid by then, I watched the tragedy of my homeland unfolded practically every night, you know, on American TV.
My guest is journalist Andrew Lamb, and he is telling us about a documentary called My Journey Home that PBS made in 2004, or it aired in 2004. I think I remember that, in fact. But you say that it's a police state now, so you can't just go in and take your cameras and say we'd like to do some filming. So,
a tourist can do that easily these days because Vietnam, even though it's a police state, it changed a lot since the normalization and the lift of the economic sanctions and diplomatic ties have reestablished with the country. But it's still essentially a police state. So if you're PBS or NBC or NPR and you go in, you still need to have license to film.
I said that it was exactly 42 years ago today, April 28th, that your life changed. April 28th, 1975, when you and your mother and your sister and your two grandmothers fled Vietnam. And you were just an 11-year-old kid. Were you scared? Because the adults, I'm sure, couldn't take anything with you. You just had to get out.
Right. I was scared, but I was also numbed because so much was happening at the end of the war. The week before that, someone had bombed the Independence Palace, which was across the street from my school. And that was when I was in the middle of taking exam. And then that was the end of my education in Vietnam as a Vietnamese kid. So from that moment on, it was chaos on the street of Saigon. And people were talking about escaping, even though there were very few options because most people didn't know that the Americans were eventually going to take them in the aftermath. So there was nowhere to run unless you're super connected and, you know, have money and fly out to some other country. Most of people in the South were sort of sitting ducks waiting for the communist government and army to take over. So it was chaotic. And so I kind of shut down. I didn't know what to think. I just sort of retreated into reading comic books until the last minute where I had to grab something and flee.
Well, I really enjoyed the foreword to your book, Andrew. It was written by somebody named Richard Rodriguez. Who was Richard Rodriguez?
Well, he's quite famous, actually. He's a well-known essayist, and he was a commentator on Jim Lehrer NewsHour. And he was my mentor. He still lives in San Francisco and is a really good writer. And he was the one that discovered me when I was in creative writing in San Francisco State many years ago and invited me to write essays. I had sort of a high idea of myself back then as a novelist, but Richard sort of recruited me into the world of literary journalism, where he showed me people like V.S. Naipaul and, Tom Wolfe and Joan Didion. And I kind of fell in love with the literary essay, and the rest is history. And I found myself becoming a journalist very quickly, even though I was in a creative writing program.
Well, I think Richard Rodriguez is a good example of what he teaches, that literary essay that he wrote. When he wrote your foreword to your book, Perfume Dreams, I don't know if I gave the title that he wrote the foreword to, Perfume Dreams, Reflections on the Vietnamese Diaspora. And you just mentioned that you were in school. And Richard Rodriguez mentions that, and you do too, that you were in a French lycée.
Yeah.
But he also says that you had, when you came to the United States, you had to learn disrespect. I thought, oh my gosh, that seems such a shame. But in what sense did you learn disrespect when you came to the United States as a school kid?
Well, in many ways, because, Vietnam is a old country, or used to be, and it's Confucian bound in the sense that you have certain behavioral expectation In school, you wear uniform and you bow to your teachers. You don't look at your teachers in the eyes, and you you have certain kind of reverence to the elder. Whereas in America, you can call your teacher by their first name, you know, and you speak a language in which there is no familial personal pronouns, where everyone is you and I. And it actually allows a kind of freedom that I didn't have in Vietnam. For instance, in Vietnamese, I could never say, I disagree with you, Dad, or I disagree with you, teacher, because it comes off as offensive. But the American I stands alone. And I can say that at dining, you know, at dinner time with while my dad says something political. And I remember being 13 or 14, just a few years in America. And I hear myself say, well, I kind of disagree with that, Dad, you know, and it came off the tongue easily. It allows for this sense of individualism that I didn't have speaking French or Vietnamese as a child.
My guest is journalist Andrew Lam, and he is featured a featured author who is coming to Chico for the Word Spring 6th Annual Creative Writing Conference tomorrow on the Butte College campus. And your book, Perfume Dreams, Reflections on the Vietnam Vietnamese Diaspora, has a foreword by Richard Rodriguez, and he talks about a famous reporter. And I learned him as Tintin, I think English, if Americans talk about him, they call him Tintin.
Right.
But I so enjoyed his references to Tintin, to this famous reporter who little school kids grow up with in France.
Yeah.
And I was particularly interested in your favorite Tintin adventure, because he had adventures all over the world.
Right.
And which one was your favorite?
It's Tintin au Tibet, which is Tintin in Tibet. And it's the one where he had this deep connection with this boy who was thought to be dead of a plane crash named Chang. But he had a psychic connection, and he was convinced that Chang was alive. And so he was vacationing in Switzerland and decided that he's going to fly to Tibet and rescue his friend who is convinced is alive. And his friend, in fact, was alive and was kidnapped by the Yeti. And he hauled the Captain Haddock, who was his friend, with him, and a few Sherpa. And it was quite a fabulous adventure. And to me, it was an extraordinary story because, he was a teenager in the story, you know, and here he was with strong conviction. And he even brought his dog with him, Milou.
Yeah.
And I just thought, when I grow up, I'm going to do that.
Well, when I was reading your book and came across this reference to Tintin going to Tibet, and a friend of mine who's also a fan said, oh, yeah, and the Chinese kid was named Chang.
Yeah.
That's not in your book, but he knew right away. He knew the story and the character's name. and Tintin was a famous reporter, and here you grow up to be a world traveler and reporter.
It's strange, isn't it, how life can turn out?
Yeah, it sure is. Well, Perfume Dreams, you have a lot of background in this story about, for example, your dad.
Yeah.
I mentioned that he was in the Army, Vietnamese. And you mentioned that you had to show respect for your father. And you have an essay in your book about your dad, and like on page 23, that chapter note, or the essay, Notes of a Warrior's Son, and you go into somewhat detail about your dad. Tell us about your dad.
Well, he was an accomplished man. He was French educated. In fact, he was French citizen before the French were defeated in 1954, because South Vietnam was sort of considered a kind of French territory. And so my grandfathers and my grandmothers were all French citizens in the South, of certain educated privileged class. And so my dad was supposed to be going to France to study as becoming a lawyer. But of course, the French were defeated and the war broke out. And then he had to choose whether or not to leave for France, where he, by that time he'll be a pauper because you have to leave all your properties back in Vietnam, or you have to stay in Vietnam and change your citizenship. So then he decided to become Vietnamese. And then joined a South Vietnamese army and fought against Ho Chi Minh's army and rose to the rank of three-star general by the end of the war. When he got to the U.S., he remade himself and got an MBA and became an executive for the Bank of America. So he's quite an accomplished man.
Well, you say that he was a commander of an Army Corps task force along the Demilitarized Zone that divided Vietnam in two.
Yeah.
And you say your father had his own ideas about things, but he relented as far as what took place there. Then you have a chapter in another of your books. I mentioned you've written three books, Perfume Dreams, which we've just been referring to. And then you also have a book, East Eats, East Eats West. And in that book, you have a chapter called Waterloo.
Yeah.
And this gives us more information, a better idea of what your dad was like. Would you read some of that essay, Waterloo, from East Eats West?
Sure. There's a moment from many years ago that remains indelible on my mind. I don't remember much on our way there to Waterloo, except that the countryside was streaked and blurred, light green over darker green, all under a persistent gray sky. Father drove. My older sister sat next to him and navigated a map on her lap. A pouting teenager, I sat behind with mother, who complained of a mild headache and wondered out loud why we needed to find this distant battlefield and why we couldn't go to freshen up at our hotel after having just arrived in Belgium. It would be dark by the time we got to Waterloo had we gone to the hotel, Father snapped. I didn't have to turn to know Mother was rolling her eyes. If she had a choice, she would have been at the hotel and would not have been stuck in the back seat as we searched for some pasture where long ago Napoleon was defeated. I thought I saw a sign in French. I say so to Father, except it took me 5 minutes to get around to doing this. He cursed, calling me names in French. I responded in French rather rudely, which surprised him since I rarely spoke the language after we came to America. I felt terrible afterwards, and the air in the car was tense. I remember thinking, were we still in the war? And I, his subordinate? My father, as a three-star general in the South Vietnamese army, no doubt would have me confined to the brig or some of whatever it was that I said. But it was half a dozen years since the Vietnam War ended, and we already turned into an American family on a European vacation, complete with a sulky teenager stuck in the back seat and his responsible but equally sullen sister stuck in front while their quarreling parents kept at it. We finally stopped and asked for directions. Father drove frantically after that. We arrived at Waterloo at last, and it was still bright out when he, my sister, and I rushed up the windswept knoll that overlooked the battlefield. Mother declined to climb and went to the shop to buy souvenirs instead. As we climbed, Father could barely hide his excitement. When we finally stood on top, almost out of breath, he began to narrate the story of the old battle. He pointed wildly where Napoleon's army stood, which direction the Prussian soldiers came from, and how the Duke of Wellington arrived with his Anglo-Allied forces to turn the tide, defeating Father's favorite military tactician and ultimately exiling him to St. Helena, where he died a few years later. I already knew the story. I also knew that Father was in part trying to make up for cursing at me by telling the whole story. It occurred to me that my older brother would have enjoyed this trip far more than me had he come. And it also occurred to me later that never once had Father told any of his children a fairy tale and that most likely he remembered none. But this story of a long-ago battle he had told many times, turning our dining table into the battlefield, our spoons and chopsticks into battalions, wolves into hills. The Duke of Wellington was drunk, Napoleon was not, but there was nothing he could do, was there, against fate. My father was second in command at I Corps near the end of the war. He was fighting at the DMZ and nearly lost his life, but managed to escape back to Saigon. He boarded a naval ship on the day Saigon fell and headed for Guam. After 4 years in America, in a remarkable feat, he had remade himself at age 46 into a bank executive. Yet father's passion remains extraterritorial. Life in America turned out to be, for him and my mother, a big letdown, a readily defined by disappointment and a deep sense of loss. They would never have in America what had been taken from them in Vietnam. For years, their biography of sorts was on display on the mantel in the living room, framed black and white photos that my brother managed to take with him as a foreign student in the US before the war ended. In one photo, father is emerging from his helicopter, silver baton in his left hand, his right reaching out to a young army officer who stands with hunched shoulders under the whirling rotor blades that send wind to press down on elephant grass. In the distance are the silhouettes of bent-backed farmers in conical hats. Father's face is dark and somber. None of the pictures show how it all ended. There are plenty of those online, however, under Fall of Saigon or April 30th, 1975, tens of thousands of them. Tanks rolling into Saigon, helicopters flying out to awaiting American ships, fear-stricken Vietnamese climbing over the barbed wire walls of the U.S. Embassy. There are many pictures of refugees in crowded cargo planes landing in the Philippines, and I suppose somewhere there are pictures of me and my mother and sister and two grandmothers emerging from one of those planes with small bags in our hands, looking very, very lost. Father left after us on a warship with hundreds of well-placed others for the U.S. Navy base in Subic Bay and for Saigon. He folded away his army uniform, changed into a pair of jeans and a t-shirt, and tossed his gun into the sea.
Andrew, I just want to interrupt for a second because when you say he tossed his gun into the sea, you come back to that one. I mean, in this paragraph, as you're reading it, just one of the things he did. He changed into jeans, a t-shirt. He tossed his gun into the sea. But it was not that uneventful as far as you were concerned.
No. I mean, I revisited that gesture in many parts of my writing because it, to me, is a mythology that ended, you know. Because I grew up in the war and my father was my hero. And that moment where he tossed it was also the beginning of my own journey.
Yeah. Go ahead and continue, please.
Yeah. After that, Vietnam, his defeat, his raison d'etre, his crucible was never far from his consciousness. The war, his role in it, have become for him the touchstone of his life. He knows wars, studies wars, had read countless books on battle strategies and warfare, and Napoleon is his hero. After so many years of hearing about Napoleon, it should have been exciting seeing the place finally. Yet that late summer afternoon, I was no longer intrigued. I was homesick for California. I missed my lover terribly, my first love, our tender kisses, the smell of our sweat. I kept replaying our visit to the beach with the breeze carrying the smell of the ocean and how shy we both were, and yet how inextricably drawn we were to one another. The orange-red sunset and unfinished sand castle between us. And all I could think of the entire trip was getting back to California to possess and to love. This was why it had taken me a long time to process that we were going into the in the wrong direction. It was also why, while Father talked on, I was miles away. It was only when he himself stopped talking and looked out to the far-off distance to where I suppose Napoleon fled that I turned to look too. But I didn't see anything resembling a battlefield. What I saw was a thin gray mist drifting lazily over a green pasture below, and in the cold air I smelled a musky odor of newly turned, upturned earth. The pastoral scene at twilight stirred in me no martial passion, but instead poetry and an unspeakable longing. Father talked on. His hair was tousled by the wind. As I watched him, the image came to me suddenly of him on that naval ship near the Philippines. The government of the Philippines wouldn't let the South Vietnamese ship dock unless all personnel turn in their arms. I imagine him, his face creased with contemplation as he stared at his gun for some time before tossing it into the churning sea below. Something, a welling, a sharp pain, rose suddenly within me then, and it surprised me that I hadn't felt anything like it before, and it felt close to pity. It lodged in my throat, and it took some effort not to cry it out loud. There on the windblown hill, with the statue of a lion on a pedestal above us as a memorial for all fallen soldiers, Father seemed so utterly alone. But then suddenly, so was I. Frightened and full of my own inarticulate longings, I had to look away for fear that Father might see tears brim in my eyes and think that I, too, was mourning for Napoleon's defeat. Was it not then that my life turned? Was it not then that I, still owned by a collective sense of loss, nevertheless took some profound step out from under his shadow? I went on to college in the fall in any case, and then after bouts of bickering with my parents, onto my own writing life, following my own passion. I've been to Europe a few times since then, to Amsterdam and even to Brussels. And though I think about it, even entertain the idea, not once did I feel compelled to visit that old battlefield again.
This is journalist Andrew Lamb reading from his book, East Eats West, Writing in Two Hemispheres. Andrew, we're going to take a short break. And when we get back, I want to hear more from your book, Perfume Dreams, Reflections on the Vietnamese Diaspora. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is a journalist who will be in Chico tomorrow, actually this evening. Tonight, Andrew Lamb will be at Roots Catering in Chico for a reading and book signing to kick off the 6th annual WordSpring Creative Writing Conference at Butte College, which takes place tomorrow. And we are hearing about his essays from his book, Perfume Dreams. And we just heard a passage from a different book, but you go into, you describe a trip that you made with your father and other family members to Waterloo in Belgium.
Yeah.
And you made reference to when you left Saigon, when you and your the rest of your family left, you didn't know what was going to happen to your dad. And so we know now, of course, this is years later, that he did make it out, but he didn't leave with you. Were you concerned as an 11-year-old that you were leaving behind your dad?
Yeah, of course. But, you know, my father was in the military for 25 years. And so for my mother, it was always constant fear because, you know, for the majority of those years, he was at the war front, you know. So every night I remember my mother pray to Buddha, you know, and Lady Guan Yin for safety, for protection. And so I was concerned and worried, but it was not something out of the ordinary because we live in a time of war. And so the only time that I began to really worry was when we got to the U.S. and still we had no way of knowing whether or not he got out and the news of the end of the war had followed us and that the country had collapsed. And so I remember my mother weeping because it was in a refugee camp and everyone was crying because we don't know what happened to the rest of our family. It was a traumatic time, I think.
Well, you do say in your essay, Notes of a Warrior Son, that when you saw him, your father was a changed man. Gone was the regal and cold demeanor of the three-star general whose presence once struck fear in others. And you said there was agitation in his eyes and he was deathly ill. You say you hadn't seen him in such a state before and it sent chills up and down your spine to see that father that you worshipped and believed to be fearless and powerful. There he was, helpless. And then you wondered what would become of the rest of you.
Yeah.
But you do, in that same essay, Notes of a Warrior Son, that when he, this gesture of tossing his gun in the ocean, you say, though I didn't bear witness to father's gesture, I can see it clearly, having imagined it over the years. I see his hand trembling before he flings the gun out in an arc over the sea, which rises to swallow it. I see his eyes looking to the water as he thinks about an uncertain future in exile, the wind sending his white shirt to billow. I was not there to witness it, but I've come to regard that moment when he jettisoned his gun into the sea as a major turning point in my own story. You say that gun resting at the bottom of the sea serves as a kind of marker. It spelled the end of my childhood mythology. And again, that's from your book, Perfume Dreams, Reflections on the Vietnamese Diaspora. So that was a turning point for you, not just for your dad, but you say for you as well.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in a war. I mean, I was born in the middle of a war. And all I remember were this sort of martial ethos that's inside the family and outside the family. I mean, you know, our national anthem was about sacrificing yourself under the flag to protect your land. So this whole narrative of leaving, of exodus, was never part of the Vietnamese culture, you know, until the war ended. And that was unprecedented, you know, this mass exodus out to sea. And it changes everything because all the stories we had told ourselves was that we were born in Vietnam and we would die in Vietnam. And it's a kind of commitment to land. And that no longer true, right? A warrior can have a second life. So why not his son?
Yeah. And in fact, I read and reread the words to your national anthem with the word blood in it. And I thought about the French national anthem with its mention of blood in its national anthem. Yeah. So you leave Vietnam and you first go to Guam.
Yeah.
And then make your way to California.
Yep.
And when you become a school kid, I mean, it's tough enough to be about that age, an 11-year, 12-year-old, going to school in a country you've grown up in. But you're going to a school where you're I don't know if I want to say oddity, but you talk funny.
Yeah.
And did you feel self-conscious about that?
Well, it was a very odd time because If you lived through that era, you probably remember how Vietnam was a very particular war because it was the first broadcasted war in American history. And so the moment I entered the classroom in seventh grade in Daly City, where we resettled, the kids actually had some ideas of what Vietnam was, right? Rice fields and helicopters and napalm. And so I was not a kid from Sri Lanka or, you know, Bangladesh. I was a kid from a place where they know someone who went, or they have some idea and some stereotype about. So in a weird way, you know, I was kind of famous, you know, because I was the first refugee kid in the classroom. Mm-hmm. And so there were all kind of questions. Did you see war? Did you see people getting killed? Did you see helicopters blown up on that sort of thing? And I actually took advantage of that curiosity. So I was sort of become the
celebrity.
Celebrities. Like, yeah, I saw war. Yeah, I rode in a helicopter. So it was, in a weird way, Vietnam was an opening gambit for me to become an American kid.
How good was your English at the time? Because you grew up, you went to French school, you spoke French. Yeah. In that chapter of your life as a young child. And of course you speak Vietnamese, and then you come to California. How was your English?
I didn't speak any. I had the only phrase I knew before I came was no money, no honey, which is what prostitutes were saying to American GIs on the street. And that was all I knew. But I learned English quite fast because, you know, I had to catch up. So I went to summer school first. And, you know, my first summer in America, I had a really great teacher who became my seventh grade teacher. And I talked about him in East West where, you know, he had a program where we just sat around and read books, you know, that we can order. And my first book was The Winds in the Willow. And I remember that book because I also had a typewriter for some reason. And so I learned how to type. And that was the first summer in America where I typed out part of The Winds in the Willow and read it out loud, you know. So by the time I went to seventh grade, I was something of a reader.
Well, and I ask about your English because people hear that you do have an accent still. Yeah. But you came when you were a kid to learn English. And you had an uncle who arrived in America when he was 44 years old.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a heartbreaking essay, Andrew, because here's this guy who's really smart, but he didn't have a talent for getting over the accent that he brought with him. And you said he was really unemployable, and it was just because of his accent. It wasn't that he wasn't a sharp guy.
Right. It was difficult because, you know, he came and then he actually went to law school and graduated. But by then, he was in his late 40s. And because of, you know, culturally, he's not American and he didn't speak English the way most people did. He couldn't find anything that's close to what his degree was. So he decided not to work at all and just ran. And he ran a grocery store in Mission Street. So.
But also it had a rather sad ending also, Andrew.
Yeah. And he died of lung cancer and throat cancer.
Yeah. He smoked and you say he drank himself to death.
Yeah, he drank himself. Yeah, to death.
Yeah. So that was heartbreaking that somebody is... Sure, he was talented and smart, but he couldn't get a job because of his accent. And you say sometimes when you that your accent is stronger than others.
Yeah.
Is that true?
Yeah.
You have various essays in your book, and I mentioned the one about your uncle and his accent.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a sentence in your essay, Love, Money, Prison, Still, Revenge. Mm-hmm. And there was a sentence in that essay that shocked me. I read it over to say, did I read that right? You wrote, 6 years ago, I could have been one of them. And you're referring to these four Vietnamese youth in Sacramento.
Yeah.
And what happened there? This was kind of recent history. This was April of 1991. What happened in Sacramento?
Well, it's still a very well-known story in Sacramento, because this refugee kids who came and they didn't do well in school, and they decided to take over the good guy's electronics store. And what had happened next was that they demanded helicopters and $1 million and ginseng. And the idea was that they were going to take the helicopter and fly back to Vietnam and shoot at Viet Cong. And so it didn't make any sense. And of course, the American media at that time completely misinterpreted them as gang kids, which was not true at all. And then the SWAT team, I mean, the police even didn't know who they were. And they actually got a Laotian monk to become a mediator. But in fact, they were Vietnamese Catholic kids. So it didn't work at all, you know, because no one knew who they were. No one knew their story. And it ended really tragic in the sense that three of them were shot because, of course, the negotiation fell apart. And one of them still serves a lifetime sentence for the death of several of the hostages that they took during the gunfight.
Well, I was surprised that just these four young men were able to hold 41 people hostage.
Yeah.
At that store. And then, though, there's that sentence you said 6 years ago, I could have been one of them. How is that possible, Andrew?
Because, you know, back in 1991, and you minus six, then, you know, I was practically still a teenager. And there was a time when I was sort of entertaining the idea of joining gangs. Because I grew up in a poor neighborhood of the Mission in San Francisco. And I was academically astute, so that saved me. But I understood that, you know, with so many of these kids, that if you cannot see the American dream, if the road, the path toward ascendancy and improvement is shut on you, the tendency is to fall back on bravado, on your own history, and trying to redeem yourself in your old man's ethos, you know. And in this case, their father was also a military soldier, I guess a soldier in the South Vietnamese army, who had been incarcerated after the war. And so in their own strange self-created mythology, they were trying to fight the old man's battle, you know. It didn't make any sense to Americans. But to someone like me who understood that whole story, it sort of makes sense, even though I am by no way condoning what they did. But that's why I wrote the piece, because I wanted to explore this kind of weird ethos of immigrant kids who don't make it, whose American dream falls, you know, falter, and they have nothing to fall back to but old memories of war and bloodshed.
My guest is award-winning writer, author, Andrew Lamb, and he has written three books, Perfume Dreams, Reflections on the Vietnamese Diaspora, East Eats West, Writing in Two Hemispheres, and a third book, Birds of Paradise Lost. And these are stories in his book. And he will be a featured writer, guest, at the WordSpring Creative Writing Conference tomorrow on the Butte College campus. We've mentioned your childhood, and when you were saying that you could have been one of those four youths in Sacramento who took hostages at the Good Guys Electronics Store. And I would like to go back to one of your earlier, or appears early in your book, Perfume Dreams, and it's the essay Child of Two Worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And go back to that date, because today is April 28th, and you begin this section that I want to ask you to read on April 28th, 1975, 2 days before Saigon fell to the Communist Army and the Vietnam War ended. And did it, for a while, when April 28th rolled around, did it bring back the unpleasant memories, or How do you feel when April 28th rolls around now?
Well, you know, my community still look at the date, not 28, but 30th, when Saigon fell and the war ended, as a day of national loss. You know, in fact, the Vietnamese word for it is Ngày Quốc Hận, you know, the day of national grief. And to this day, in little Saigons up and down the coast, there are still people who wear white headbands, which is what you wear to a funeral, and publicly mourn the loss of Vietnam and the loss of that war. For me, of course, I made peace with it. I've been back to Vietnam many times, and I even wrote about the meaning of that date and how it changes for me over the years. Mm-hmm. But for other people, it's still, including my father, it's still a date of shame and trauma that I don't think they can overcome because they've lost so much.
Well, would you read that section of your essay, Child of Two Worlds, that begins on April 28, 1975?
Sure. On April 28, 1975, 2 days before Saigon fell to the Communist Army and the Vietnam War ended, my family and I boarded a cargo plane full of panicked refugees and headed for Guam. I remember watching Vietnam recede into the cloudy horizon from the plane's window, a green mass of land giving way to a hazy green sea. I was 11 years old. I was confused, frightened, and from all available evidence, the khaki army tents in the Guam refugee camp, the scorching heat, the long lines for food ration, the fetid odor of the communal latrines, I was also homeless. Places and times when they no longer can be retrieved tend to turn sacrosanct. Home forever lost is forever bathed in a certain twilight glow. Even after many years in America, my mother still longed for the ancestral altar on which grandpa's faded black and white photo stared out into our abandoned home. She missed the carved rosewood cabinet in which she kept the enamel cover family albums and my father's special French wines from Bordeaux. And she yearned for the antique porcelain dining set covered by faded blue silk. She fretted over the small farm we owned near the Binh Loi Bridge on the outskirts of Saigon, where the chickens roamed freely and the mangosteen and guava trees were heavy with fruits when we last visited, and where the river, dotted with water hyacinths, ran swift and strong. This is the time of year when the guavas back home are ripened, Mother would tell the family at dinner time. So far from home, Mother nevertheless took her reference points in autumn, her favorite season. Autumn, the dark season, came in the form of letters she received from relatives and friends left behind, brown and flimsy, thin like dead leaves, recycled who knows how many times. The letters threatened to dissolve with a single tear. They unanimously told of tragic lives. Auntie and her family barely survived. Cousin is caught for the umpteenth time trying to escape. Uncle has died from heart failure while being interrogated by the Viet Cong. And yet another uncle is indefinitely incarcerated in a malaria-infested re-education camp, and no news yet of cousin and family who disappeared in the South China Sea. The letters went on to inquire as to our health and then to timidly ask for money for antibiotics, for a bicycle, and if possible, for sponsorship to America. The letters confirmed what my mother, who had lived through two wars, had always known. Life is a sea of suffering, and sorrow gives meaning to life. Then, as if to anchor me in old-world tragedy, as if to bind me to that shared narrative of loss and misery, Mother insisted that I, too, read those letters. What did I do? I skimmed, I skipped, I shrugged, I put on a poker face and raked autumn in a pile and pushed it all back to her. That country, I slowly announced in English as if to wound, is cursed. That country, mind you, no longer mine. Vietnam was now so far away, an abstraction, and America was now so near, outside a window, blaring on TV, written in the science fiction books I devoured like mad, a seduction. Besides, what could a scrawny refugee teenager living in America do to save Uncle from that malaria-infested re-education camp? What could he do for cousin and her family lost somewhere in the vast South China Sea? He could, on the other hand, pretend amnesia to save himself from grief. My mother made the clucking sounds of disapproval with her tongue as she shook her head. She looked into my eyes and called me the worst thing she could muster. You become a little American now, haven't you? A cowboy. Vietnamese appropriated the word cowboy from the movies to imply selfishness. A cowboy in Vietnamese estimation is a rebel who, as in the spaghetti westerns, leaves town, the communal life, to ride alone into the sunset. Mother's comment smarted, but she wasn't far from the truth. Her grievances against America had little to do with the war and the United States involvement in it. Her complaint against America was that it had stolen her children, especially her youngest and once most filial son. America seduced him with its optimism, twisted his thinking, bent his tongue, and dulled his tropic memories. America gave him freeways and fast food and silly cartoons and sitcoms, imbuing him with sappy, happy ending incitements. Yet it could not be helped. For the refugee child in America, the world splits perversely into two irreconcilable parts, inside and outside. Inside, at home in the crowded apartment shared by two refugee families, nostalgia ruled. Inside, the world remained dedicated to what was. Remember the house we used to live in with the red bougainvillea wavering over the iron gate? Remember when we went to Hue and sailed down the perfumed river for the night market, and that night the sky was full of stars? Remember that when Uncle showed us that trick with the cards? Inside, the smell of fish sauce wafted along with the smell of incense from the newly built altar that housed photos of the dead, a complex smell of loss. Inside, the refugee father told and retold wartime stories to his increasingly disaffected children, reliving the battles he had fought and won. He stirred his whiskey and soda on ice and stared blankly at the TV. Inside, the refugee mother grieved for lost relatives, lost home and hearth, lost way of life. A whole cherished world of intimate connections, scattered and uprooted, gone, gone, all gone. And so inside, I, their refugee child, felt the collected weight of history on my shoulders and felt silent. Outside, however, what do you want to be when you grow up, Mr. K, the English teacher in eighth grade asked. I had never thought of the question before, such an American question. But it intrigued me. I did not hesitate. A movie star, I answered, laughing. Outside, I was ready to believe, to swear that the Vietnamese child who grew up in that terrible war and who saw many strange, tragic, and marvelous things was someone else, not me, that it had happened in another age, centuries ago. That Vietnamese boy never grew up. He wanders still in the garden of my childhood memory. Was I had gone on, hadn't I? It was a feeling that I could not help. I came to America at a peculiar age, pubescent and not fully formed. Old enough to remember Vietnam, I was also young enough to embrace America and to be shaped by it. Outside in school, among new friends, I spoke English freely and deliberately. I whispered sweet compliments to Chinese and Filipino girls and made them blush. I cussed and joked with friends and made them laugh. I bantered and cavorted with teachers and made myself their pet. Speaking English, I had a markedly different personality than when speaking Vietnamese. In English, I was a sunny, upbeat, silly, and sometimes wickedly sharp-tongued kid. No sorrow, no sadness, no cataclysmic grief clung to my new language. A wild river full of possibilities flowed effortlessly from my tongue, connecting me to the new world. And I, enamored by the discovery of a newly invented self, I sail its iridescent waters toward spring.
This is Andrew Lamb. He is an award-winning author, and he's reading from his book, Perfume Dreams, Reflections on the Vietnamese Diaspora. And this was his essay entitled Child of Two Worlds. You're mentioned in that chapter of how Vietnamese viewed Americans. Mm-hmm. Remind me of your essay called My Vietnam, My America, mm-hmm. and how what Vietnam meant to Americans when they mm-hmm. thought of Vietnam and what America meant to the Vietnamese. And how is that different?
It's very different because for a long time, Vietnam became a symbol for American tragedy, American loss, and,
embarrassment even?
But also a sense of being betrayed, you know, by its own government and so on. And whereas America remained for the Vietnamese, despite the war, a symbol of potential change and transformation, especially after the war, when so many Vietnamese left and became Americans, it kind of opened a floodgate for those who stay behind, who imagine themselves becoming Americans as well. So that in a way, you know, while Vietnam is sort of a vault or which tragedy, is a metaphor for American narrative, America for the Vietnamese was a symbol of personal improvement and transformation. So it's a very odd thing. And it continues to play out that way, you know?
You said that it represents freedom. America represents freedom for mm-hmm. Vietnamese. So you have these stories when you're traveling around, like refugee detention centers, like one on the edge of Hong Kong that you visited. What did you learn when you visited detention centers?
Well, you know, in every place you go to, the one thing you learn besides the tragedy and the history that's unfolding in front of you is also the nature of who you become. Because I went to a refugee center as an American journalist, but in part as an activist, wanting to write about sort of this invisible people for American audience. And as a Vietnamese who care about his own people. But when I stayed there for a certain number of weeks, I came to realize how American I was. That, in fact, secretly I had, I was glad that I had American passport so I can go in and out of this camp, you know, and that, in fact, I was so different than these people who, you know, were trying so hard to cross this line, which became much harder after the Cold War. And so many were facing forced repatriation that, in fact, I realized that I had completely transformed by the time I entered that refugee camp. And that I was not a Vietnamese, but in fact, pretty much an American journalist. And I sort of carry myself that way.
Well, we will look forward to meeting you, Andrew. Yeah. Tonight at Roots Catering, you will be doing a reading and book signing as the first event of the 6th annual WordSpring Creative Writing Conference at Butte College, which will take place tomorrow. Thank you so much, Andrew, for talking to us about your book, especially Perfume Dreams, Reflections on the Vietnamese Diaspora.
Well, thank you for having me.
You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.